Okay, welcome to week five. And I'd like to think we've earned this one, in the sense that after stress, addiction, OCD, and depression, now we're ready for a change of pace. Relaxation and the next week logotherapy. These are the positive side, we hope. And steps towards dealing with some of the challenges we outlined in the first 4 weeks. As we did with the first four, I want to focus on broad philosophies, ideas that I think have relevance to the specific topic and beyond to broader kind of mental health in Judaism. One wouldn't think that relaxation would require, you know, an hour-long class, but in Judaism, everything requires an hour-long class. Never simple, never straightforward. Sorry, it isn't a matter of just booking a vacation. What I want to look at fundamentally, though, is the question of whether Judaism is comfortable with the idea of relaxing. And I'm going to unpack that a little bit. Take a look at source number one, please. From the Mayo Clinic's website, Relaxation Techniques. That's what the article is called. We'll talk about techniques in a bit, but right now this particular paragraph is really about benefits. When faced with numerous responsibilities and tasks or the demands of an illness, relaxation techniques may not be a priority in your life. But that means you might miss out on the health benefits of relaxation. This is why it's good for you. This is good, because for those who are already relaxing, this is, you know, confirmation, and for those who are not, this will give us stress. Practicing relaxation techniques can have many benefits, you know, like the rich get richer, that's the idea. Practicing relaxation techniques can have, well, I couldn't make jokes for the first 4 weeks. This is my opportunity. Yeah, practicing relaxation techniques can have many benefits, including slowing heart rate, lowering blood pressure, slowing your breathing rate, improving digestion, maintaining normal blood sugar levels, reducing activity of stress hormones, increasing blood flow to major muscles, reducing muscle tension and chronic pain, improving concentration and mood, improving sleep quality, lowering fatigue, reducing anger and frustration, boosting confidence to handle problems. Is there nothing this will not do, right? This is, you know, whatever you want, whatever goal you have for your health, just relax and it will all come to you. If only, right? So that's sort of on a basic level. When you look at this set, though, of benefits, something that leaps out certainly to me is the balance of what one might consider intellectual or emotional benefits, right? Things like, improving concentration and mood, reducing anger and frustration, and also physiological benefits, lowering blood pressure, slowing your breathing rate, improving digestion, muscle tension, chronic pain. Benefits are both psychological and physical if a person is able to relax. Not just that. This is fascinating. Source number two. When I saw this article, I sent it to my kids. The article is titled, "I Kicked My Smartphone Addiction by Retraining My Brain to Enjoy Being Bored." It's a long title. Indeed, research suggests that people who want to come up with creative ideas would do well to let their minds drift. A 2014 study in the Journal of Experimental Social Psychology found that bored people, quote, are more likely to engage in sensation seeking, that is, to look for activities or sites that engage their minds and stimulate the brain's reward centers. In other words, your brain is looking for something to do. And in the absence of outside stimulation, it is going to try to generate that stimulation itself. These people are more prone to, quote, divergent thinking styles, the ability to come up with creative new ideas. Thus, boredom may encourage people to approach rewards and spark associative thought. Your kid says to you, your grandkid says to you, "I'm bored," you say, "Good. Now you're going to be creative." The next line. In another recent study, researchers at the University of Central Lancashire set out to test the link between boredom and creativity. They asked 80 participants to perform boring tasks, like copying and reading numbers from a phone book, I remember those, and then to drum up as many possible uses for plastic cups as they could. The groups that completed the boring phone book tasks beforehand came up with more creative answers than the control group that had not. Right? You give two people a boring task, and then you have them come up with ways to play with cups. Those who have been bored will come up with more ways to play with cups. That's the idea. You know, when you do these kinds of experiments, you can't let them know what your goal is. Right? Yeah, you have to, as part of the experiment, they can't be aware of the significance of the results. I don't know how you explained this to people. When you brought them in for this trial, and some of them, you had them sit there and copy out numbers from the phone book, and then you said, here are some plastic cups, play with them. I don't know what they thought the experiment was about. But nonetheless, the idea is that relaxation is good for you in source number one, for what it brings you intellectually, for what it brings you physically, and it causes your brain to seek creative avenues, and apparently that will continue even after the boredom has ended. Now you're playing with cups, but the creativity that's been stimulated will be manifest in the things that you do afterwards. And you think about it. This resonates culturally, right? The idea that where do people come up with their best ideas? Bathtub, shower, right? When they're sleeping. Well, sleep has another element to it. I don't want to go into the sleep piece of it. That's actually a whole other scientific discussion. But fundamentally, we're familiar with the idea that when you're not doing anything, so to speak, your mind is not directly engaged, you may well come up with great creative ideas. And they're giving you here a basis for that idea. So, you know, who wouldn't want these benefits, right? If you sold a product on TV, right, you had a commercial that said, would you like to reduce your anger, reduce your frustration, improve your digestion, maintain your normal blood sugar levels, right? And you'll be more creative. What do you have to do, right? I'd be like waiting, like, what's the product, right? And the answer is go on vacation. Oh, that was easy. The problem fundamentally with it, from my perspective, is source number three. And that's a Mishnah from Pirkei Avot, authored by Rabbi Chanina ben Chachinai. More about him in a moment. Rabbi Chanina ben Chachinai said, one who is awake at night, and one who walks alone on the road, and one who clears his heart for emptiness, in Hebrew, Mifane libo levatala, this person makes himself liable for his life. Rabbi Chanina ben Chachinai, Pirkei Avot, for those who may not be familiar, Pirkei Avot is part of the Mishnah, the core legal text of Judaism, but it doesn't deal directly with matters of law. Instead, it gives guidance for life. A lot of Pirkei Avot is focused on relating well to others. A lot of it is about faith in God and concepts of reward and punishment, as well as the value of studying Torah. It's more or less the Jewish equivalent of motherhood and apple pie. And Pirkei Avot tends to be, you know, if you're familiar with ideas like, Im ein ani li mi li, if I am not for me, who will be for me? The world stands on three things: Torah, service of God, and acts of generosity. Like, there's nothing to dislike about Pirkei Avot. So Rabbi Chanina ben Chachinai, within this text, tells us, one who is awake at night, meaning intentionally awake at night, somebody who says, I'm gonna stay up at night, one who walks alone, and I should clarify, because the commentaries do, when he says awake at night, it doesn't mean awake at night doing something productive. It means just, I'm just gonna, you know, stay up. One who walks alone on the road, and one who clears his heart for emptiness, to do nothing, is liable for his life. Take a look at source number five. I'm going to come back to number four. Look at number five first. Rashi, classic commentator, explains what it is that he thinks Rabbi Chanina ben Chachinai is saying. One who is awake at night and he thinks empty thoughts in his heart. for emptiness, one who clears his heart for emptiness, to be empty of words of Torah. He says, you know what, I'm not interested in doing something productive, I just want to veg out. I just like to not have to focus on anything meaningful or productive right now. I just want to clear my heart for emptiness. And Rabbi Hanina ben Chachinai, he said, liable for his life. Take a look at source number 6. This is called Avot Rabbi Natan. Avot Rabbi Natan is a text which expands on some of the ideas in Pirkei Avot. And here it says, Rabbi Hanina ben Chachinai, he said, one who is awake at night, he must only be involved in words of Torah. As Proverbs 6:22 says, when you walk it, Torah will lead you. So therefore, you should only have Torah with you. That should be the focus of your pursuits. It's a little tough, no? Does it allow for me to take a vacation and relax?
How do you become creative?
Yeah, how are you going to be creative?
Learn on your vacation.
Sorry?
You can learn on your vacation.
You can learn on your vacation. How much of a vacation is it going to be? No, in all seriousness. Like, how much of a vacation will it be if my imperative is that I can't sit down by the water and just, you know, stare off at the sky? Right? That's the fundamental question. And I brought you source number 4, which I'm going to now come back to, because it is important to understand who Rabbi Hanina ben Chachinai is, because the lessons that are found in Pirkei Avot are attributed to particular sages, and we tend to understand those lessons as sort of their thing, that which they used to tell people, the advice they used to give. So Hillel used to say such and such. Shammai used to say such and such. So the author's personality and life story is important to understand when you read the sentence. So take a look at number 4, where we get a midrash that tells us a little bit more about Rabbi Hanina ben Chachinai. It ties into the story known as the story of the Asara Haruge Malchus, or Asara Haruge Malchut, the 10 martyrs. Anyone familiar with the 10 martyrs? Sorry, the 10 martyrs? Okay, so this is actually found in the traditional liturgy twice during the year. When is their story told? Yom Kippur and Tisha B'Av, right, and Tisha B'Av. It's told on both occasions with a different focus in each. On Yom Kippur, it's told associated with the Avodah, the story where in Musaf, we read about the sacrifices performed in the temple, in the Beit HaMikdash, on Yom Kippur. Then we read about our sacrifices, essentially. On Tisha B'Av, it's one of the keynotes, one of the elegies, paragraphs of grief and mourning for the destruction of the temple. The story of these 10 martyrs goes back to the period of the Second Temple, when the Jews are living under the Romans, and the Romans have decided that they're looking for ways to put down these constant Jewish revolts. They see that taxing them isn't doing it, they see that physical force isn't doing it, and they recognize that the study of Torah, the maintenance of our ideology, is what's keeping us going. And so they decide that they're going to chop off the head of the Jewish people, essentially. They're going to find the leaders and they're going to execute them. Now, the story as it's told in those paragraphs from Yom Kippur and Tisha B'Av makes it sound like it happened all at once, but it's not. It happens over a period of time. But there are 10 martyrs in particular who are identified. Some of the biggest names we're familiar with. Rabbi Akiva is one of the 10. And all of them are murdered brutally. So take a look at source number 4, which is about Rabbi Hanina ben Chachinai, who is also one of the 10. Then they brought out Rabbi Hanina ben Chachinai. That day was Friday. And for his entire life he had fasted. From the age of 12 until he was 95 years old, he would fast on Friday. That was his practice. Build up anticipation for Shabbat, atone for errors during the week. His students said to him, "Our master, do you wish to taste anything before you're killed?" He replied, "Until now I fasted, not eating and not drinking. Now, when I don't know which way I will go," right, meaning after death, "I don't know how God is going to judge me, you tell me to eat and drink." And instead, he accepts Shabbat. He begins to recite Kiddush, and then the Romans execute him. But I bring this because it's important to understand who the speaker is. Rabbi Hanina ben Chachinai, the one who says never relax, is serious. This is someone who fasted every Friday, right? Who was considered one of the great leaders of the Jewish people, and yet says, I don't know how God is going to judge me in the next world. He's somebody who's very demanding. He's somebody who's very exacting. So we have to keep that in mind when we read his advice, which is, you know, if you ever turn your heart to emptiness, if you ever dedicate yourself to relaxation, you're liable for your life. That's the personality that's behind this. You follow? It is important to recognize that. Nonetheless, here he is tapping into something that we find in other sources, as we're going to see within Judaism, which is a tendency not to trust relaxation. A tendency to feel that there is something non-Jewish about going on vacation. I don't say non-Jewish as in non-Jewish as Jews and the world, but non-Jewish in the sense that it's not consistent with Judaism. That's what we're going to see here, and we have to resolve it, because we had all these great benefits in source number one and source number two.
Definitely.
Yes?
We're here because we're talking about mental health. We're talking about mental health issues, not healthy mental health, but mental health issues.
Yes.
Relaxation on its own is something that we can all say realizes is good for us.
Okay.
But when you have a mental health issue, emptying your mind may be the last thing that you wish to do. Because when you do that, you actually have to live with your own truth. And all those thoughts and all the things that are causing you distress come flooding in.
Right.
So relaxation under the umbrella of mental health is actually a stressor.
Good. So this is a very important point. I wouldn't necessarily use the term relaxation for it at that point. More the phrase that you use, like emptying one's mind,
yeah.
Right? The idea that people need productive channels for their function, and that will help them to cope with, any number of problems potentially, I think is an important one, and one that we're actually going to come back to a certain extent. It's going to matter even more next week when we talk about logotherapy, because that's a focus within logotherapy as well. But yes, you're right. There is an issue which we're going to come back to somewhat. If you want to look ahead quickly to see, I don't remember what number it is. 22. So we'll see that. We'll see it a little bit there when we talk about the Sunday neurosis issue. Yes. The answer to what you're saying is yes, and we have to incorporate that into the conversation. For people who are dealing with mental health issues, relaxation may actually be a double-edged sword. Rita.
How does this relate to doing meditation? When you do meditation,
I'll repeat it.
Would you do empty your mind of negative thoughts and focus on
right.
positive? And you can meditate on things in the Torah and in the Psalms.
Right.
Empty your mind of negative thoughts.
Right. So Rita asks how this relates to meditation, which can be considered a positive. Rabbi Aryeh Kaplan wrote several books on meditation in Judaism. But I think that when you're dealing with meditation from those perspectives, it tends to be meditation towards something. It isn't so much about the emptying as what I'm then going to focus on. And I think that's a key difference between what they're describing here for relaxation, where the goal really seems to be to get away from, as opposed to what I'm going towards. I think that's true. I'm not entirely sure. Let's go to the next phase, because actually that may help us to answer that question. Take a look at source number 7. I want to define two different terms, which people usually conflate, but I think in Judaism requires some separation. One is relaxation, and one is relaxing. And they're not the same thing. Relaxation. Take a look at source number 7 from HealthLink BC, since Ian wanted a Canadian source. So I gave you a Canadian source. I keep bringing American sources. To relax means to calm the mind, the body, or both. Relaxing can quiet your mind and make you feel peaceful and calm. Your body also reacts when you relax. For example, your muscles may be less tense and more flexible. This is describing a state of relaxation. One who is relaxed has these benefits, the benefits that we described above in the first source. It is when your mind is quiet, you're peaceful, you're calm. The truth is, this can be achieved through meditation. We have the we're going to talk about techniques, but it's an idea of the mind simply being in what we are terming a relaxed state. Peaceful, calm, not tense, and that influences the body as well. That's relaxation. Relaxing are the techniques you use to get there. So I brought you, again, off of the Mayo Clinic. They're north, you know, they're more north than we are, even if they're not in Canada.
They have one in Minnesota, too.
Do they? I only knew the Minnesota one. Okay. Types of relaxation techniques include autogenic relaxation. Autogenic means something that comes from within you. In this relaxation technique, you use both visual imagery and body awareness to reduce stress. I skipped a lot of text from their website. You can go to their site and see more. I just wanted to show the categories. Progressive muscle relaxation. In this relaxation technique, you focus on slowly tensing and then relaxing each muscle group. This can help you focus on the difference between muscle tension and relaxation. Visualization. In this relaxation technique, you may form mental images to take a visual journey to a peaceful, calming place or situation. Right, Rita, this may be along the lines of meditation as a technique. Other relaxation techniques may include deep breathing, massage, meditation, tai chi, yoga, biofeedback, music and art therapy, aromatherapy, hydrotherapy. Techniques, means of relaxing versus relaxation, the state of actually being relaxed. And the reason why I'm taking pains to distinguish between the state of being relaxed and the way you get there is because as I was preparing this class, I finally understood something that had eluded me for a very long time. Judaism loves relaxation, but it hates relaxing. It is absolutely true. How do you say relaxation in Hebrew?
Shabbat.
We're going to come back to Shabbat. That's a good point. How do you say, what are the phrases in Hebrew? There are multiple terms. Sorry? Lanuach is to rest. Yishuv hadat, having a settled mind. Dat rechava, having a broad, relaxed mind, is another turn of phrase. And our sources, as we're going to see, speak wonderfully about that relaxed state. They love it. They think it's great for us. It enables people to pray. It enables people to learn Torah. It enables people to interact with each other well. Relaxation is wonderful. But when it comes to the act of relaxing, to how we get there, suddenly the sources have a much harder time. Take a look at the sheets and you'll see what I'm talking about. We love relaxation. We consider it good for us. If you take a look at source number 9, you find God modeling this for us with, as Dahlia said, Shabbat. God says, between me and the children of Israel, it, Shabbat, is a sign forever. For in 6 days God created the heavens and the earth, and on the 7th day he halted, and then the word in Hebrew is? What's the word in Hebrew? Vayinafash. Vayinafash. Which Rashi explains means he rested lanuach. That's different from the word Shabbat. It's very important to make this distinction. The word Shabbat means what? The word Shabbat means to stop, to halt. How do you say strike in Hebrew? Shvitah, right? It's from the same thing. One of the keynotes, one of the elegies that are recited on Tisha B'Av of grief, talks about the halting of the temple, the Beit HaMikdash, when it was destroyed. Shabbat is the term that is used. Lishvot is to halt. Lanuach is to rest. Two different terms. The halting of activity is not necessarily always relaxing. What he's doing here is saying, Bayom HaShavi'i, on the 7th day, Shabbat got halted, and adds the word, Vayinafash, and he rested. But God doesn't need to rest, right? It's basic to the Jewish concept of God. Sorry?
hot and
nefesh. Yes.
So anybody in a flesh, it's no longer hot and nefesh.
That's fine, but it still doesn't apply to God. You're right, right? The point is that you do have, right? Ruchama points out, you have menuchat haguf, rest of the body, menuchat hanefesh, rest of the spirit, rest of the soul. But the Jewish concept of God is that neither of those is necessary. And when God does something in the Torah and uses a phrase that shouldn't have relevance for God, the answer is it has relevance for us. There's something that we are meant to learn, something we are meant to relate to in this human description that's being given. And in this case, we are being taught a lesson, which is that Shabbat is not only a day to halt, stop creative work, but it's actually a day that is supposed to be this kind of recharge. You're supposed to have this relaxation. Stephen.
So you cease from everything that God has done for 6 days. He ceased. And separated it.
Take a look at source number 10, please. Rabbi Moses Maimonides. One's goal should be to have a complete and strong body, so his spirit will be straight in order to know God. You need to have a healthy spirit as well, in order to have knowledge of God. Knowledge of God does not come in the absence of this kind of settled mind. And it leads to religious success. When we talked about OCD, right, we quoted those authorities, the rabbinic authorities, who said that if Judaism is making you miserable, that's a sign that it's not from Judaism. This isn't a desirable goal. That just drives people away from it. Judaism has to be something that one approaches in a satisfied state, not in a compulsion state. And this is applied to various religious experiences. Take a look at source number 11. There's a concept of approaching Shabbat with a sense that all of your work is complete. The whole week is over and everything is done. Now, no one lives that way. You don't finish everything Friday afternoon. It's funny, there's a midrash that talks about the fact that when the Torah describes Shabbat, it describes God as halting on the sixth day. And working and then halting on the seventh day, excuse me. And the idea is that he works down to the wire. And he halts just at that moment when Shabbat starts. And they said, oh, like me. Right? This is God modeling. The truth of the matter is we don't finish everything we need to finish in time. We never have. And so you take a look at source number 11, Rabbi Yaakov Baal HaTurim, author of one of the principal codes of Jewish law, wrote, a person cannot possibly finish all of his tasks in 1 week. Rather, he must see himself as though his work is complete by every Shabbat. You have to get into a mental state of, that's all done. It's over. You know, kids don't appreciate Shabbat. I didn't appreciate it until I was old enough to have a job, right? And then at that point, you recognize what it means to put everything away and say, I can't do this. This is away. This is done. It's out of my mind. And if you can succeed in doing that, then I believe very much in what Rabbi Yaakov Baal HaTurim says. He says, there is no greater pleasure. And that was true for me. I was working on Shabbat. I was a synagogue rabbi. Nonetheless, the sense of there's nothing to do about all of these things is a relief. That's the idea. Marilyn.
But there's also other issues. You may be a caregiver. Your work never stops.
Right.
Shabbat, but
correct.
Your life goes on.
Right. No, that's certainly true. This is an idealization. This is not, you know, in real life, you may be a caregiver, but even without that kind of a stronger situation, you know, you're a parent, you're a sibling, you're a child, and there are all these, you know, people you relate to, there are friends. You know, realistically, other elements are going to come into play that are not banned on Shabbat, and therefore are not part of the rest experience. Elaine.
I know we touched on this before, but I don't know if I can lead too much into it, but is there significance in the fact that it's expressed in the number 10 source,
yeah,
that the strong body, it sounds like the strong body will promote the strength of spirit.
Yeah, that's very much a Maimonidean idea, and it's a Greek idea before our sources expressed it. You know, it's an idea of the relationship between the soul and the body. in which supporting one supports the other. It's very funny. I gave a class last night for physicians on giving a patient a terminal diagnosis. And the one of the points that that an author of an article had made was that science no longer believes that bad news is going to harm a person's health. And I said it to the doctors who were there, knowing full well that at least half of them were going to say, that's just not true, right? And the answer is that, as somebody there noted for me, there are sort of ebbs and flows within medicine and their trends. And this article was written 10 years ago, and it's absolutely no longer believed. Meaning, we talked about this when we dealt with stress, right, in our first week, and we showed the physiological impact of what is fundamentally an emotional state. Right, the fight or flight response, your mind, you bet, affects your body. What Rambam is doing here is he's going the other direction. And he's saying having a strong body is going to help with your mental state as well, which is worth discussing, but I'm going to go further with it here. So that's one example, is Shabbat. Another example, source number 12, Rabbi Elazar Papo, moving ahead in history, about 500 years, talks about the need for relaxation, to be in a relaxed state for success in Torah study, in service of God. A settled mind is highly necessary for involvement in Torah and service of God, and especially for those like us, orphans of orphans, whose heart is absent. What he means by that is, we had great figures in the past, but we don't know them anymore. We don't have a connection to them. It's like being an orphaned generation. And any distraction at all suffices to distract us from serving God. It is appropriate to flee mightily from scattering of the spirit, a phrase in Hebrew, pizur hanefesh. Meaning, scattering of his wealth and similar commercial distractions. The idea of, I have investments here and investments there and I have to run around and take care of all of that, is a destructive state. He's not the one to invent that idea. You find that idea in Judaism 700 years before him. But he's the one I quoted here. Better to have dry bread and tranquility than a distracted heart and perpetual pain and fear. You need to have a relaxed state. And so you see that in the next source, in the Code of Jewish Law, we find out that somebody whose mind is not settled is exempt from putting on tefillin. In practice, we don't do this, because people would never wear tefillin. But that's the idea, is you can't do a mitzvah if you're torn like that. Then Isaac of Abarbanel, in source number 14, commenting on a verse in the book of Daniel, in which he is told to be strong and steady in order to receive a prophetic vision. So he is told there to stand straight and have a settled mind. Without a settled mind, you cannot experience prophecy. And there are actually many sources that that support this idea. So the relaxed state, being relaxed, Judaism loves it. Absolutely. Yeah, that's what Shabbat is supposed to provide for you. It's necessary for success in Torah study, closeness to God. Mitzvah, everything needs you to be relaxed. But here's the flip side. Judaism has real trouble relaxing. So take a look. First of all, a couple of sources on how it's considered to be bad for you to relax. Take a look at source number 15. One who follows a healthy lifestyle... One who follows a healthy lifestyle is not following a good path if his goal is only to have his body complete and his children doing his work and supporting him. He says, that's no good. Get a job. Number 16, Rabbi Menachem Meiri, clearing one's heart for emptiness, that passage we read from Pirkei Avot in the beginning, means not involving himself in anything which can lead to a slumbering heart and desolate thoughts. And this goes back to your point about the risks for people with mental health issues in this clearing of the mind. And again, we're going to come back to it a little bit later, but you see it right here, the idea that it's not so good for you. It's not so good for Torah study either, for one to say, I'm going to take time off. We discussed in week one the passage where God says to Joshua, you shall speak words of Torah day and night. And that is interpreted by at least one sage in the Talmud to mean you're not entitled to have free time. If you have a moment available, that has to be spent in, and invested in Torah study. I brought you a stronger source here. Source number 17, there's a verse in the book of Numbers, Zot HaTorah Adam Kiyamut Be'ohel. In context, it has to do with laws of purity and impurity. But the Talmud here seizes on the phrase Zot HaTorah, which begins it. This is the Torah. And then the rest of the passage, when one dies in a tent. And it says, how do we know that Torah endures only in one who kills himself for it? And the answer is, because the verse says, this is the Torah when one dies in a tent, and the image is the tent of Torah study. The message here is, if you want to succeed as a student of Torah, you have to give your life over to it. You can't do it part way and expect to find true success. What happened to relaxing? Right? It's gone. Another example, source number 18, classic. Rabbi Tarfon said, this is also Pirkei Avot. Hayom katzar v'amlacha meruba. The day is short. The work is great. The workers are lazy. The pay is great. And the employer, God, actually I have a capital E on employer, right? The employer presses. He's pushing. Get back to work. That's the idea. Not only that, I love this passage. Source number 19. You know, there's a verse in the Torah that says, Sheshet yamim ta'avod v'yasita kol malachtecha v'yom ha-shvi'i shabbat l'shem elokecha. 6 days you shall work, right? Sheshet yamim ta'avod. 6 days you shall work and do all of your tasks, and on the seventh day you shall rest. So usually people read that verse and say, that's a mitzvah of rest on day seven. Not this source. Look at this. This is a midrash. It's a halachic midrash. It's meant to reflect Jewish law. 6 days you shall work. Rebbe, also known as Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi, leading sage of the 3rd century, he said, this is another decree, separate from resting on day 7. Just as Israel is instructed in the commandments of Shabbat, so they are instructed regarding work. Get a job for 6 days. Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah said, work is great, for the Shekhinah, God's manifestation, was not manifest upon Israel until they worked. And he quotes you the verse in Exodus, which says, make a sanctuary for me, God says, and I will dwell among them. You have to make the Mishkan. You have to build something, then I'll be manifest. But you have to become construction workers, or developers and contractors. Huh. Sorry? How about it? Right, although that's a pragmatic statement. Right, Ruchav points out the classic line, if there is no flower, F-L-O-U-R, there is no Torah. And if there's no Torah, there's no flower. Correct. Right, I think that's a practical sentence, though. And then Rabbi Akiva, who has his own note along these lines, but I'm going to skip it just in the interest of time. What Rabbi Akiva says is that we have all these rules about sanctified property. If you dedicate property to the temple, and then somebody uses it for their own sake, they have to bring a korban, a sacrifice to atone for it, they have to pay a fine for it. However, if you work in the temple, you can be paid out of these sanctified items. So doing work it permits you to benefit from holy property. That's that last statement in source number 19. But the overall point that I think we're seeing, certainly I see in these sources, is that Judaism values being relaxed, but it doesn't want you to get there. And so now I have a problem. Because you need to get you have to get there somehow. It isn't as though you just, snap your fingers and now you're relaxed. So how does one achieve it? If this is a desirable state, it's desirable in terms of health, and it's a desirable state in terms of being fulfilled Jewishly. So how do you square the circle? How can you promote relaxation and not want to relax?
Is that mindfulness?
Interesting. Because you can do that without taking a time away from other things.
But it's like transition from sitting down.
I want to think about that. It's an interesting question. Let me think about that one. I might send that out in a follow-up email. I hadn't thought about that. The question was, is that mindfulness?
Oh.
I want to think about that one. I'm not sure. So, I think fundamentally, in order to understand what this is all about, you have to go back to something that is useful in general in Judaism and frankly any system, when dealing with ethical challenges. What makes a good ethical challenge is the fact that you have a reasonable argument on both sides. right? You're standing in a store, and you see an item that you want and you can't afford. Do I steal it or not? Is not an ethical challenge, I hope. Right? It's fairly straightforward. Don't do it. There isn't an argument to take it on the other side. Moish.
They
I'm not talking about... That's where I'm going next. I was going to build it a little differently. We'll take the Les Mis one, right? If, on the other hand, it's somebody whose child is starving and they need a loaf of bread, that becomes an ethical question. But why does it become an ethical question? Because there's a very strong imperative on the other side of, I'm saving someone's life. There's no ethical question if it's just, should I steal or not? If it's, should I steal to save a life? Or, should I steal and I'm going to pay them back later? Or, it's the pharmacist, Heinz Dilemma, right? He has medicine, and it's just become wildly expensive, and I can't save somebody without it. That's when you have an interesting question. And now you have to start weighing. And I think that's what you have to recognize in terms of the relaxation question. Right now, we've just built up one side. Relaxation is apple pie. Relaxation is wonderful. It'll cure you of all your ills. It'll make you happy. You know, why in the world would you not do that? How could Judaism be opposed to that? And the answer is because there's another side. And that's what I think is key here. Judaism is afraid of relaxing because of a couple of harms that can be identified in it. What harms are there in relaxing? Idleness. Good. I actually point out, before I get to Shauna, but Ian pointed out idleness. Go back for a moment to the source in Pirkei Avot in number 18. We said the day is short, and the work is great, and the workers are lazy. Right? The workers are lazy. There's a lot of work to do, and it's not going to get done. That's one concern. Shauna.
Well, I was thinking through this last piece in the context of having a high school boy in a religious school that has really long hours. And
yes.
Friends who don't have boys like that, they say, well, your kid doesn't get to relax. And then the counterpoint is sometimes, well, they're busy learning or they're not getting into trouble because they have no free time.
Right. The truth of the matter is that the kids in any school don't relax anymore. That's a whole other problem. But even if they're ending school earlier.
I think it's just the context. I think you can kind of hold both, because I think the issue with the relaxing part is not so much the relaxing, but it's relaxing going into something empty or relaxing and going into trouble. Like, it's there's a context.
Right.
That's problematic.
Right. And I think that's an interesting point, which is that the relaxing isn't necessarily value neutral. Not necessarily value neutral. A person can end up getting into trouble, right? It's not our phrase, but idle hands, devil's work, right? That's not one of ours. But the reality of it is that a person can get into trouble as well. I saw a couple of hands, and then I want to go further. Judith, and then Moish. Yeah.
Looking at the broader picture, I think Judaism, and I'm not sure how this is, but at the basic end is similar. So,
right.
So the process of relaxing is built into the basic tenet of Judaism, which is
to Well, it's you're saying it supports it or it's against it?
Well, it so supports it that the actual process of relaxing is constricted because there's just so much to do.
Right.
That our job is as Jews to.
Right. Fundamentally, we have a lot to do. That's really what it comes down to. I'm going to come back to this in a bit. I'm going to take Moish and then I'm going to go further. Sorry, Steve.
I just want to add to what Marie said in Victor Frankl's work.
Yes.
His title of Man's Search for Meaning.
Yes.
Judaism is not just value, it's the search.
Right. So that's week six. Is Viktor Frankl and logotherapy, but I am going to quote him shortly. Shortly as in now. Just about. But there's one problem fundamentally is the practical problem. There's too much to do, and the workers are lazy. Second problem, take a look at source number 20, please. A Mishnah Ketuvot. I think I might have quoted this on another occasion. Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel said, one who vows that his wife may not work must divorce her and pay her ketubah. The ketubah payment is supposed to be paid in the event of divorce. It's a payment that the husband agrees to from the start. In the event of his death, it comes from his estate. In the event of divorce, then he has to pay it to her. And he says, if a man takes a vow that his wife shall never work, well, either he's going to have to get the vow repealed. That's one possibility. But if not, then he has to divorce her. Why? For idleness leads to shiyamum. Because if you don't have occupation, right? This wasn't a world with a lot of hobbies 2,000 years ago. If you don't have occupation, it leads to shiyamum, which is best translated as depression. Boredom in modern Hebrew, mishamim, in modern Hebrew. But in their language, and as the commentators take it there, they're talking about melancholy. That's the way that they look at it. And this goes back to your point about the dangers of relaxation. We are designed, we are built to be creators. We are built to do. And we're built with imperatives. The very beginning of the Torah, we are told, Vayitzav Hashem Elokim al Ha'adam, God commanded human beings. That's what separated us from the animals. We've talked about that on other occasions, I know. The separation from the beast occurs when God says, you have a job to do. And I brought you the quote from Rabbi Yosef Dov Soloveitchik in source number 21. God takes man-animal into his confidence, addresses him, and reveals to him his moral will. We are designed to achieve. And if we relax, we run the risk of losing purpose. And that's something that shows up not only in our sources as Jews, but it shows up in general sources as well. And here I bring you Viktor Frankl. This is finally source number 22. The spiritual crisis of retirement constitutes, so to speak, a permanent unemployment neurosis. But there is also a temporary, periodical one. The Sunday neurosis, a depression which afflicts people who become conscious of the lack of content in their lives, the existential vacuum, when the rush of the busy week stops on Sunday and the void within them suddenly becomes manifest. That's the problem. When you have nothing to do, you run the risk of losing a sense of purpose. That's number one. But number two, it also makes us lazy. I brought you a quote from David Krakauer in source number 23. Krakauer is an evolutionary geneticist, which is a cool phrase to say, evolutionary geneticist. But listen to what he says here in this article from Forbes. Krakauer underscores another underappreciated threat we all face, and he's talking about the effects of technology. He says, humans are lazy. Yes, he discovered. Technology makes life easier, allows us to experience and accomplish more. What I worry about almost more than anything else is a certain kind of mental laziness and an unwillingness to engage with the difficult issues. So the same concern of Rav Papa, and of Rabbi Tarfon, in Pirkei Avot, the workers are lazy, is being voiced by Krakauer here. The same concern of Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel in source number 20 about not being able to work and that leading to depression is the Sunday neurosis that Viktor Frankl is reflecting on here. So we have a fear, we have a concern that relaxation means work won't get done, and relaxation can leave life empty. And that's why Judaism finds relaxing so difficult, even if it wants us to be relaxed. However, why have one solution when you can have four? Judaism has multiple ways to deal with this problem. Well, three really. Four, actually, come to think of it. There are four ways in which Judaism deals with this problem. The first way that Judaism deals with it is to say, make your relaxation nutritious. How? By taking the opportunity to do something that has value to it, even as you relax. So take a look at source number 24. This always gets misquoted. People like to say that Rabbi Shimshon Raphael Hirsch, a rabbi in Germany in the first half of the 19th century, said that when a person dies and goes up to the heavens, God is going to ask, have you seen my Alps? It's a great line, but it's not what he said. This is what he said, source number 24. He says, I almost believe that all you homebodies would one day have to atone for your staying indoors. And when you would desire entrance to see the marvels of heaven, they would ask you, did you see the marvels of God on earth? And then ashamed, you would mumble, we missed that opportunity. Same idea as did you see my house? Just more words. But fundamentally, what he's saying is, this is what you're supposed to do in this world. You're supposed to enjoy what God has given you, and that has, so to speak, nutritional value religiously. And so it's okay to relax in that way. There's a Talmudic passage from the Jerusalem Talmud which talks about there being a mitzvah to try every kind of fruit that has been created. But that's already further afield. That's more about enjoyment than relaxation. I'm trying to distinguish between the two. But Rabbi Hirsch's point is well taken. The idea that relaxing becomes sanctioned in Judaism in the event that you can identify something of value in it. And that's one take. A second approach is that relaxing will be acceptable if it's in order to be able to do good. So take a look at source number 25, Rabbi Yosef Karo in the Shulchan Aruch, in the Code of Jewish Law. He's not talking about relaxing, he's talking about eating and drinking, but the application I think is clear. He says, eating or drinking for your own pleasure is not praiseworthy. One should intend to eat and drink in order to live to serve the Creator. He says, you have to have that goal in mind. Now, that sounds very intense. You might have an easier time with the next source, Rabbi Shimon Shkab. Shimon Shkab, who was killed in the war, said, in my humble opinion, the Torah's mitzvah of you shall be holy includes every foundation and root of the purpose of our lives, meaning everything we do is towards holiness. For all of our work and struggle to be dedicated continually for the good of the community, that we not use any deed or action, benefit or pleasure without some element of benefiting others. We always have to be helping others, he says. And when one straightens his path and yearns continually for the paths of his life to be dedicated to the community, then whatever he does for himself as well, for his physical and emotional health, is also associated with this mitzvah of holiness. For through this he also helps the community. For by helping himself, he helps the many who need him. So he says, if you're preserving yourself and you live your life as one who is serving others, then even what you do for your own sake is really something you're doing for the sake of other people as well. And that's a second way that Judaism looks at it. It's relaxing in order to be able to do good. I'm going to not take the question right now because I want to make sure to get through the last couple of points here. The third idea here is the idea that relaxing has value as part of being a human being. And I need to unpack that a little bit. Yeah, in the beginning, as we've talked about, in the beginning of the Torah, human beings are created just as the plants are, just as the animals are. We're brought forth, dirt from the ground. We're given a blessing of bear fruit and multiply, and so on. Then, as we said, the first interaction of human beings with God changes everything. God gives us a command. He suddenly brings us into his confidence, as we saw from Rabbi Soloveitchik, and at that point, we have a relationship with God. But something happens right after that in the Torah. The very next passage, after God speaks to human beings and says, you know, there's something I want from you, the very next passage is, Lo tov heyot ha'adam levado. It's not good for human beings to be on their own. They need others. There is a need for community. So that, right after God gives us spirituality, right after God says, you have a spirit and you're meant to accomplish and you're meant to perform your mission for me, God gives us what may be termed sociality. The idea that you're supposed to also, in addition to spirituality, you have the aspect of yourself that is social, that relates to other human beings, that has a match, that has a, not just a match, but once you talk about having other human beings, it means that you have spouses and children and parents, that you have siblings, that you have friends, that you have nieces and nephews. It means that a life within a community. And what that means for me, as I read it, is that a human being has two imperatives. One imperative is draw close to God. That's from that first verse. And the second imperative is draw close to community. And a person who is only going to do the first, a person who's going to say, I live a life of religious obligation and I'm never ever going to relax, is going to have a really hard time on the community side. Because they won't develop all those aspects of the soul that are fundamentally human in character, that they have in common with all the people around them. Right? Being a monk, right, doesn't really work in terms of being able to relate to other people and experiencing life with them. And so the third way to look at this, at relaxing, is to say, yes, it's true, relaxing has certain downsides, potentially the work won't get done, and so on. Nonetheless, there's also the flip side, the positive side, which is it accomplishes another kind of work. It makes me human. It makes me able to relate to others, to understand them, to sympathize, to empathize, and fundamentally be part of their existence. If you can't relax, you're never going to be able to do that. So that's a third justification for it. And then the last, and then I'm going to sum up, is relaxation sometimes is a mitzvah. Sometimes it is put in mitzvah terms, right? We talked about Shabbat already as one example. I brought you another example here in the last two sources on the sheet. This is regarding the holiday of Shavuot. What do we celebrate on Shavuot? So traditionally, people today think about the giving of the Torah, right? The Chumash never says that the Torah is given on that day. What was the original explanation for Shavuot? The first fruits, right? The first produce, the Bikurim. You bring the first produce to the temple and you thank God for what He has given you. Look at the way it's described in the Torah, though. Source number 27 shows you two verses. One verse describes Shavuot as a celebration for you. The other one says, on the seventh day shall be a celebration for Hashem, your God. I'm not sure why I picked that. I should have picked a different one. I know why I picked that. All right, don't worry about it. The bottom line is that you have two different characterizations of what this day is meant to be. You have two different ways to look at it, and the Talmud says, you know what? It's both. And that's the phrase in source number 28, Rabbi Yeshua said, you split it. Chetzio l'Hashem, chetzio l'Hashem. Half is for God, and half is for you. I think I may have made a mistake in my verse. I think I'm talking about holidays in general, not Shavuot specifically. I have to go back and check. But the idea is still the same. The idea is that there's an element of it which is for God, and then there's an element that is to be for you, and in that, relaxation becomes, once again, mitzvah. So what we've said is this. First of all, relaxation has very clear benefits for the human being. Emotional benefits, physical benefits, psychological benefits. Noting that clearing your mind may not always be the best thing for a person. The problem we have in Judaism is that we want that relaxed state. It enables a person to relate to God. It enables a person to carry out mitzvot. It's a good thing. But relaxing means taking time away from the things we are supposed to do. It means that we're not involved in studying Torah. It means that we're not getting things done. So the fundamental problem that we have is that we want too much. We want everything. How in the world do you accomplish everything? And the answer is that there are times when there will be ethical weight to relaxing, when it will be considered to have value such that Judaism will view it as something to pursue. Whether because it brings a person to say, Marabu Ma'asecha Hashem, how great are God's deeds, I appreciate what God created, I'm going to go see something and that will accomplish relaxation, even as it will also bring me closer to God. Or relaxing, which enables me to do good by letting me recharge. Or relaxing, which is part of being a human being. which will enable me to fulfill that imperative of not being alone, but being part of society, or specifically relaxation that is actually a mitzvah in its own right, like Shabbat and like on holidays. There's much more, as always, to say. Next week, though, God willing, we go to logotherapy. If you're not familiar with it, you're going to enjoy it. That's a favorite topic of mine. Thank you very much.
Thank you.